Hi, and welcome back to another segment of Our Community Unsheltered. I'm Candace Michelle, and with me today is Diana Cooper, the Executive Director of Brookings Core Response, an organization here that hooks people up with services that can address their needs. Hi, Diana. How you doing?
Hi, I'm doing good. It's a beautiful day outside now.
It is absolutely gorgeous. So can you reiterate for folks what kinds of services people need help with, you know, navigating mm-hmm. or getting hooked up with, or, you know?
Yeah, a lot of what we connect people to are services that are already provided either by state entities or federal entities or local organizations or even, you know, healthcare providers and things like that. So one of our main focuses as community health workers, obviously, is getting people connected with long-term and consistent medical care. So we want to, essentially we want to divert people from using the ER to using either same day appointment or, you know, best case scenario, getting them a primary care doctor. So that's one of our main goals, is getting people medically checked out and stable, because there are a lot of unchecked chronic diseases going on with the people that we serve. And not just people without housing, but just in general and in our area, we have a lot of resistance to providers, or to medical care, but I think it's a little bit more than just resistance to that. I think we would do a disservice to throw that off on people and say they're just resistant. I think we've had traditionally here some struggle with our own medical system, so people are hesitant for multiple reasons.
Well, and I think that they're not just hesitant, but continuously what happens is your doctor leaves and goes somewhere
right,
else,
yeah.
right? So you might have had a doctor for like 6, 7, 8, 10 years, and suddenly they're gone. And you're kind of left going, well, now what?
Yeah, that actually happened to, so, you know, I'm a huge proponent of primary care and, you know, more utilizing better, utilizing more appropriate forms of healthcare, because I worked in a CCO, so I was able to see, you know, the difference in care, not having anything to do with money or cost or anything like that, because CCO members don't pay, but understanding the difference in the care that you're receiving from the emergency room, from the urgent care center, from your primary care. And so I can literally see as an outsider how people are getting better long-term results with primary care and even urgent care than they would be going to an ER. But yeah, you know, even myself being a huge supporter of primary care and you know, getting hooked in with a doctor, I currently do not have a primary care provider. And the reason for that, when we moved back over here in 2019 in the summer, you know, we took our time. We didn't rush. It took us a few months before we finally were like, okay, we need to get primary care providers and get the kids, make sure they have their checkups and all of that. And we spent several months connecting the kids with a pediatrician, you know, the appointment, doing all the new patient paperwork and the intro appointment. And then Matt and I both getting a doctor here. And then within the span of maybe a month, all six of us lost our providers, different providers. So, yeah, Matt's doctor, actually, I had known him from the Valley. He actually was a primary care provider in the Valley, and I had worked with his office several times when I worked at All Care, and I just knew him to be a very good provider, and you know, their office was always great. So Matt saw him. And I saw the nurse practitioner that was under him, and she was lovely. I loved her. Mm-hmm. And Matt's doctor passed away at the very beginning, before COVID hit, I think. Mm-hmm. And within just a couple weeks, my doctor left the practice, and then that left them with no primary care. So Matt and I lost ours. And then COVID hit maybe a few weeks later, and we lost the pediatrician for all four of the kids. And since then, we've reestablished, especially Eric, because he has some higher needs, medical needs. we've reestablished him with some primary care and we're working on getting everybody else. But, you know, the last year and a half has been pretty busy. So, you know, it's not a quick thing to get a primary care provider. You have to wait for the appointment and
do all of
the paperwork.
And then there's the, you know, the whole building up of trust kind of thing because, you know, you can go in there and the first couple of appointments are kind of like, you know, where are we? And are we compatible?
Right.
And do we see things the same? And
it is hard to get a provider that you trust.
Yeah.
A lot, you know, and especially if you already have, you know, if you already have some medical issues that Matt does. So he got connected with another provider pretty quickly because he has to for medication reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as much as I have health issues now and then, I don't really have any like ongoing health issues that I necessarily need to see a doctor all the time.
Yeah,
so
but you had
mine
a,
went by
you
the
had a migraine, right? You had a migraine.
I did
week,
have a migraine.
So,
yeah, that like... actually the last migraine I had before that was when I still had my primary care. So it would have been, you know, at least a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to get them very frequently. And I always did have a provider because even with myself, I saw how much better care I got with primary care than going when you go to an ER, you know, especially if you're younger and you've, I don't know, just you have a certain look to you, which apparently mm-hmm. I do. you know, when you go to an emergency room and you are in pain, it's very, I don't know what it's like to be the doctor on that side, but it must be very, you know, they must be very full of anxiety when someone comes in and they're talking about pain because the last thing that the providers want is to have, you know, regulations and government all down their neck for writing a couple of pain pills. So what I see is oftentimes they just won't write, you know, pain medication, which can be really difficult for people who are experiencing severe pain. So, yeah, so having a primary care for me is obviously a good idea and to be able to follow me in case I do have migraine.
Seriously, and if you have things that have occurred kind of regularly in your life mm-hmm. and you have a primary that has been with you for a while, they know that. So, you know, you can go to your primary or just telephone your primary and say, "I'm having another bladder infection," you
right.
know? And if I don't get some antibiotics within 6 hours, I will be doubled over and then I will have to go to the emergency room. And usually, you know, if your provider has been with you for a while, they go, "Oh yeah, yeah, I know. It'll be at Freddy's in an hour." You know, it's so much. Otherwise, you do end up having to go to the emergency room and then they do all of those tests on you. And and like, you know, 5 hours later, you're sweating bullets because you're in so much pain.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember one time going to the emergency room in Medford when we were living over there, obviously. And it was probably, it was like 9 o'clock on a Friday night. It's just the worst day you want to be in the emergency room because if you're someone who, now I'm speaking from personal experience here as someone who's used narcotics before, illegally, obviously. And so when you're in that position and you're somebody who uses and I suppose it could be using for legitimate reasons too. I don't want to just blanket that over that everybody going on the weekend is some junkie. But, you know, when you are someone who is addicted to painkillers and the weekend hits, the ER is the place where you're going to go because there's no doctors open to prescribe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's no, I mean, everything's just shut down. There's no way to get anything. So the only way to get anything is to go to the ER. So, you know, here I am with a full-blown migraine on a Friday night at 9 o'clock and I go into the hospital and I don't know if you've been to the Rogue Regency, the medical center over there, the big hospital.
No.
Uh-uh. Asante. So
no.
I've been there a lot, unfortunately. And when I went in, the entire waiting room was full and there were people actually standing and I just, I knew I was going to be a long night.
Yeah.
And I was there. I fell asleep on one of the benches. I was there for 8 hours before I got in to see anyone. That was the last time I went to the ER for one. After that, I discovered their urgent cares over there, and they're amazing. Just amazing centers over there.
The only time that I ever had a migraine was when I was in my 20s, I think, and it was the middle of the night and, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning or something like that. Ridiculous, right? And
oh, gosh.
It was awful.
You, like, woke up with a migraine?
I maybe hadn't gotten to sleep yet. I mean, I was in my 20s. Come on. You know, we were probably partying, all right?
I just totally saying. Don't go to bed at 9 o'clock. What?
I know. And so I said, you know, get me to the emergency room because I can't deal with this pain. I mean, And he gave me a shot of Demerol, and boy, that was it.
Yeah.
I went to sleep. I never.
God, Demerol, yeah.
And that's, I never had a migraine again, so I don't know what.
I'm like super sensitive to opiates now because I did use heroin before, and I, you know, used to the point where my body just like does not know what to do with. And I've been clean for so long that it's this weird, I have a tolerance, but my body also doesn't know what to do with it. So, which really affects me now being clean. And when I do have procedures or things like that where I have to take medication, it really messes with my body. And I'm just so sensitive to them that, I mean, you know, when I'm in pain, like when I had to go in for a procedure one time, they did have to give me Demerol or morphine or something. Right. It's just basically, okay, you're going to give that to me. I'm going to throw up a few times and then I'm going to pass out. And that's all there is. There's
no,
like, you can give me the nausea meds, but it's not going to work.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of the Demerol, though.
Yeah. It's not exactly like fun, right?
No.
I mean, just all you doctors out there who think that, you know, people are looking for fun. We're not looking for fun, okay? We're just looking for the pain to stop. It's,
You know,
trying to work or trying to live, trying to take care of kids, trying to do anything.
Oh, I couldn't do. Yeah,
your world is just full of pain is like, holy man.
I, you know, the kids were actually very, I mean, I was really impressed with how like careful they were the whole, you know, it was several days where I was dealing with this and I just couldn't handle any sound and anything. And, you know, Noah, my youngest, he's 8. And so he just, I mean, Matt took care of me, but Noah took care of me too.
That's
great.
He
just, you know, let me lay my head in his lap and.
Oh, that's sweet.
So they were very helpful, but it's very painful. I'm sure anybody who has ever had a migraine can understand. It's kind of a whole different level of pain.
No, it takes over your entire world. I know. And my daughter's had them since she was 15. And when she gets them, she's down for several days.
How does she have them often?
Yeah, fairly often.
Yep. Yeah.
And I have not been able to find anything to address it. They don't know what it is that's causing the migraines. They, you know, she has to go to bed a few days.
Yeah. I mean, it's really a disability, and it's a weird one because you can't tell. It's not like, you know, when you're, it's not like missing a leg where you can say like, okay, this is how it is and this is how I'm going to have to adapt.
Right.
You don't know when or how or why.
Exactly.
So it's just, so I've had them since I was 18 is when I first started getting them. And I had meningitis, and I might have spoken about this before. I can't remember, but I had meningitis here, and I must have had it for maybe 6 weeks before they caught kind of what was going on.
Wow.
And it was viral meningitis. So, you know, bacterial can kill you within just days. I don't know, hours maybe. It's very serious. Mm-hmm. Viral meningitis will kill you if it goes, it can kill you if it goes untreated, but it's less likely. So I got viral meningitis and ended up with some scarring and ramifications
on
from
your
that.
Head.
And, on the meninges sac that goes around your brain. And so now, you know, I can get migraines. I used to get them maybe once a month, twice a month. Mm-hmm. And now it's maybe once a year, but they're very serious when they do come. So
yeah, no, thank you. Right. Me and pain are not good friends. We just aren't. I have a very low tolerance for pain. I do too.
And actually and this is why I think I may have spoken about it, because that's originally what brought on my addiction is it's so ironic the way things work. I had the meningitis. I was going to the hospital like every day. I mean, it was terrible. You know, it was worse than a migraine. It was just everything. And I was going every day to the hospital, and then they thought I was drug seeking, even though I'd never used drugs. And then I ended up getting over the meningitis and having ongoing pain and had to take medication. And that spiraled out of control until I started using drugs. And so it's this weird, it was a very weird.
Kind of self-fulfilling prophecy kind of thing. Yeah, that is very weird.
They're like, we don't want you to be an addict. Here's more pain meds.
Well, and you know, truthfully, there is nothing worse than being in pain, right?
Right.
So there has to be some way of dealing with the pain and at the same time being aware as a prescriber of, you know, how it could tip over and what to do. But at the same time, you don't cut people off. Right?
No, I mean, actually this is kind of sort of segues into a really interesting topic, because when I worked at AllCare, you know, I worked in care coordination, and all of what I did basically was helping folks who were trying to navigate their medical care. And sometimes, you know, there was a lot of resources that they needed, like a lot of what we do now, but it all revolved around their medical care, because it's a CCO. And so there were times where, you know, a lot of times I dealt with denials for like pain management and things like that. That was a pretty common one. You know, people would call me and say, I got denied for pain management and I don't know why. And so I'd help them try to figure it out. Why did we deny them? What could be different? Mm-hmm. Well, there was a person in particular that the story kind of sticks with me and really shows how the pendulum has swung the other way. So this particular person had diabetic neuropathy, and it was quite painful. I mean, it was very obvious to me. It was obvious to all of us and her providers. And her doctor was adamant, you know, she needs pain treatment, and so wanted to refer her to pain management. Well, the doctor had already diagnosed her with the neuropathy. There was already a plan in place, but the doctor wasn't willing to prescribe the pain meds. So that was why they wanted to refer to pain management. And that's not an appropriate case for pain management. Oh. Pain management is to get it under control, and then that care should be handed back to your doctor. That's where it belongs. Mm-hmm. Long-term care belongs with your primary care provider. Right. And so so I tried to explain that to the primary care, that that's why we're denying it, because you need to be the one to write it. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, to get an insurance company, especially Medicaid, to cover a narcotic medication is pretty hard.
Yeah.
And so for us to say to this doctor, hey, we absolutely will fill this, we will cover this, but you need to be the one to write it because you're the primary care. And primary care, and this happens all over, this happens everywhere. Primary care said, we don't write narcotics. Well, so then we talk about, okay, what other prescribers in your doctor's office do, and that this person needs to be hooked up with them. None of the prescribers were willing to write narcotics. That's unethical. That goes against do no harm. There has to be someone in your office that is willing to write for narcotic medication. And the reason is because there are legitimate reasons why people do take narcotics. You know, if you break a leg, I'm not taking some ibuprofen.
No.
I'm sorry. You know, you're going to have to give me something a little stronger.
Yep.
So we've run into this rut now to try to steer people away from becoming addicts. We actually have closed the hole for those who, and it's not everybody. I see this if you're getting private, if you have private insurance, you are three times more likely to be prescribed narcotic pain medication when you have minor pain than you would be if you were on Medicaid or, I don't know about Medicare, because Medicare is sort of its own beast, Yes. But in you know, I've had a lot of people that I work with who have Medicare and seem to be okay getting some of their prescriptions filled, depending. But when you have Medicaid versus having private insurance, there is a clear and defined difference in the way that your pain is dealt with.
That's not okay, is it?
No.
I mean, really?
It's not.
It's not. That's called discrimination.
It is. Yeah. And I don't know how that goes unchecked for so long. But having worked in Medicaid, and then also having, you know, some pretty clear references for people who have private insurance, it's pretty obvious. And I think this is well known anyway, at least in circles that, you know, people who are dealing with health insurance. So we do have this sort of phenomenon where the people who are at the lower end of the economic income scale don't get effective pain treatment and are often referred to pain management immediately instead of the primary care trying to sort of discover that. And I'm not, you know.
And that's if there is pain management in your community.
Right,
which,
yeah.
You know, we had pain management and then it went away.
Yeah.
And then maybe we had it again and then it went away. I mean, I actually don't know if we have it here. I don't think we do.
That would be a good question to ask. It's not something
you can count on, you know, because my husband like cracked a couple of vertebrae in his back and he's still in pain and now his knees are bone on bone.
Mm.
And he can't get real pain management. It's just, you know, he can't get it prescribed. It's like,
yeah,
and then he feels bad for even asking, right?
Oh gosh,
because he's thinking, you know, oh, you know, am I being an addict or something? It's like, come on, honey, you're 74 years old, right? You need to not be in pain. I don't think we're in danger of you turning into a drug addict.
Right. I think at this point, that's sort of how I feel about it. And, you know, clearly, I'm not an expert in all things. So we'll just disclaimer.
Oh,
yeah, we'll just throw the disclaimer out for that. I think, you know, once you hit a certain age, I'm like, you should just be able to get whatever you want. I don't really care. You want acid? Sure. Just whatever. I mean, really.
Well, you've put in your years of being a productive right. member of society, right? I mean, you really have. So
right.
you ought to be able to have
enjoy
a
little, it.
Exactly. Enjoy the golden years, which are full of pain.
I mean, the last thing you should have to do when you're 75 and bone on bone with knees is have to fight with your insurance company and pain management doctors on what's the best non-narcotic pain medication that they can prescribe to you?
I know. It makes absolutely no sense at all. But at this point, everybody's a little bit gun shy, right?
Oh, sure.
You know, all of the stuff, the oxy, mm-hmm. you know, all of that stuff. And
yeah,
you know.
I remember, I was in the middle of that pendulum swinging the other way and mm-hmm. and was sort of caught in that crossfire. Of course, myself, having sort of went downhill by that point, you know, I turned to street drugs. So when they cut me off and, you know, right around, it was, I think, probably 2011, 2012, they started mm-hmm. kind of like, you know, that door started closing for a lot mm-hmm. of people. And when they cut me off, it just you know, I had already kind of gotten into that mentality anyway and was already supplementing with buying things on the street. And so I imagine a lot of people, you mm-hmm. know, that's how a lot of people start, is they're getting it from their doctor.
Yep.
There really is a lot of truth to that it is a gateway and that mm-hmm. you're, you know, a lot of people start off being prescribed that medication before they turn to street drugs. And I don't know what the formula is there on you know, how to make that safe. I don't know what everybody's so different. So there's no way to say, okay, if we prescribe one of these a day, they won't be an addict. There's just no way to know.
No, you can't possibly judge that. No. Everybody's completely different. Yeah.
And I feel for the doctors for sure having to try to navigate that, but it just, we're not in the middle here. We've went the other way. It's mm-hmm. not helpful for a lot of people. And honestly, I mean, we deal with that a lot. There's stigma attached to addiction that says, if you are an addict, you should not be prescribed narcotic medications, because it can further your addiction or can cause right. other things. So oftentimes people, especially active users, and this gets really convoluted, but active users, get denied medical care for things like pain and, anxiety and things like that. They get denied care, far more often than most other folks because they're active users. And so the assumption there is that anything I give them, they're going to get high off of, but that doesn't mean they don't need care.
Exactly.
So, I mean, that's got to be a fine line. I'm not a doctor. I don't.
No, but as long as our medical system is all about the bottom line, all about the money, then proper care is not going to be given to people.
Right. The intention won't be there if yeah, I agree.
No. I mean, you have to actually be willing to spend more than the 20 minutes that Medicare allows
right.
the doctor to spend with you,
right.
right, to get to what the issues are and how to deal with them. And, if the point is to help somebody manage their pain, at a certain point, you know that the pain level is actually decreasing because they are healing. Mm-hmm. And so the prescription could be either tapered or changed but you have to be, you actually have to have a system that cares about people's well-being, not the money. So,
would really, what I see in Jackson, Josephine County and a lot of other areas that, and this is not just a plug for the work that I do, but, what I see making a difference in a lot of clinics is community health workers and peer support specialists, not even just clinical social workers, but actually just laypersons. And, there's a couple of clinics in Medford. One is La Clinica. And although I don't know as much about La Clinica, so I probably shouldn't speak to that, but I do know that they have a lot of, they have community health workers and such. But then there's Rogue Community Health, and they have a whole team of community health workers. And these are people who spend time outside of the office, but also in the office as well, meeting with people around all different kinds of health goals. And so they're really an important part of the care team. So that doctor is able to read a chart and showing a lot of time spent with this patient. I mean, first of all, it's a really good return on investment because mm-hmm. we have someone who's paid much less than a doctor, but they're able to do longer term work with this person and gather more information.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
So they get a whole picture of the person.
Right.
And
exactly. Exactly.
And that's helped with a lot of the, that's actually helped with a lot of the pain management referrals mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. I know. So mm-hmm.
that's excellent.
Yeah, so we do need some more.
Well, someday we'll have good medical care here, right?
I think so. I mean, I always, every day I feel like I wake up and I think, okay, I'm going to think positively about everything that's going on here. We do have these good things. We just need to fine tune them. But sometimes it can get disappointing because the reality is that we don't.
And one of the reasons that we don't is actually the affordable housing crisis.
Yeah, it's a big one.
It's a big piece. And, it's a big piece, not just in terms of, the workforce that's here. And when I talk about the workforce, I'm not really talking about the doctors, although they are part of workforce.
Right.
And they can't find places to rent either. It's not, it's not just people who are working at Burger King who can't find places to live. Mm-hmm. But it's a crisis that, according to Oregon Senator Merkley, is, you know, throughout the entire country. And we just aren't dealing with it. We're not dealing with it. And, you know, it hampers us in so many ways here in this community, because if you don't have a place for even your doctors and nurses and pharmacists to live,
right?
They're not going to come if you don't build it, right? They're not going to, because there's nowhere for them to live.
Yeah, that's actually why my provider ended up leaving at the beginning of last year, too, was she was not able to find stable housing. She was in a temporary space for a while, and that was just supposed to be temporary.
Yeah.
And it didn't turn out to be. So, and, you know, there was a lot shifting in that clinic anyway, but, you know, she was not able to find housing here.
No.
So,
no.
You know, and she's gone back to Grants Pass, so.
Yeah, exactly, where there might be some housing. I mean, again, it's a national problem, so it's not just right. us in Curry County. But I think that the problem is exacerbated here in Brookings because, you know, we're right on the coast, so it's obviously it's beautiful and cool and, you know, all of that stuff. But also, you know, some of the long-term rentals in town are being turned into short-term vacation rentals. And it's happening at a really alarming rate. It's like 2 or 3 per planning commission meeting.
Yeah. Yeah, we were just talking about this actually at the vaccine event. We were a few of us were just talking about that, how many. Mm-hmm. And there was several people that are from out of either they don't live here in Brookings or Curry County. I think Coos County is where some of them are from. But we were all kind of talking about it, and they were talking about just, I mean, some of the ways other city governments and county governments are taking a look at short-term rentals. And I had explained that our council feels that is, you know,
government kind of, overreach.
Overreach, that's what it was. So, which
makes me laugh every time I think about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's absurd.
That is exactly their job. Okay,
I get that to a certain degree. I get that it can be difficult to walk the line between, you know, overreach and then just ignorance, because there's on one side they're just kind of ignorant to some of the issues and they don't look at the issues, and then some, you know, there could be a call for, you know, that certain things that governments do are overreach. But I get that's a fine line.
Like banning sleeping in your car. Now, that could be government overreach.
That certainly seems like restriction of our liberties.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
I mean, if I wanted to go... okay, so this happened maybe 6 months ago. You know, Matt and I, we don't really like fight in all the years we've been together. There's no like fights, you know, even within our addiction, it was just like me looking at him angry or something, you know, we're very lucky in that we've never had any like knockout, you know, there's never been us out screaming on our lawn at 2 a.m. So,
For that, your neighbors are very happy.
I'm sure.
Very grateful.
Yes, they probably are. I mean, my kids screaming at 2 a.m., I don't know. But you know, about 6 months ago, it was very stressful. It was me, you know, I was having an internal issue, and it was like 11 o'clock at night, and I just like lost my mind, and I could not maintain control, and I just needed to like get some space for a minute. So I drove downtown and parked somewhere, and I even thought like, well, I'll just sleep in here tonight. And again, this is not like, you know, Matt was not being some horrible creature. I was just literally at the end of my rope.
Right.
And so I, you know, here I am, and I didn't even have shoes on. I just sort of left. And so I'm there just sort of in some sweatpants and a sweatshirt downtown in my car at 11 o'clock at night. And I'm thinking, you know, I'll just sleep here if I have to, or I'll just stay here for a couple hours. Mm-hmm. And then I really thought about it, and I was like, you know, I can't. Like, someone will come knock on my door.
That's right.
And wouldn't that be interesting? The police yes. come knock on my door and it's me. Yes. But yeah, it's why can't we have space when we need space in something that is legally ours? My legal vehicle on a street that I pay taxes for, why can't I, if yep. I needed a night yep. to, I mean, I get it, yep. go rent a motel. But during the summer, you know, this wasn't no. summer, but
and if you don't
summer,
have the money,
no motels.
And if you don't have the money to rent a motel, why?
Right. I mean, I'm just saying, like, why yeah. make it illegal to sleep in your vehicle? That seems like such a waste of time. And
yep.
I have opinions on this, but, you know, we all deserve to use the space that we need, that is available to us, that is free for us, that is within our rights.
But look at the huge difference between that, right? I mean, so we're talking about the right of a person to sleep in their own vehicle, which is their property on a street that they paid for with their taxes. Mm-hmm. And that's perfectly legal to do, right? Which is like, to forbid them to do that. That's mm-hmm. that's legal. But to actually do some planning in the city to put right. a cap on how many vacation rentals there are in a city,
The other wow. cities, counties, and states do all the time.
Yeah, of course. Because we talked about this city before, planning. Yeah. It's city planning, you know? Of course.
And not only that, but I mean, just having some sort of sustainability as a city. Yeah. Don't they want that peace of mind?
Right.
Because I looked at the last three and that came through as short-term rentals. And all three of those, I don't think I'm incorrect on this because I just looked at them, but mm-hmm. all three of those were three-bedroom, two-bathroom houses. That is family housing. That's not some little cute little studio you've got attached to your property that you want to rent out as an Airbnb. These mm-hmm. are, you're taking away, family housing.
Yes.
And or at the very least, roommate situations. And one of them, you know, I know on it's well, it's down by where you're at. One of them mm-hmm. is on Moore Street. Mm-hmm. And that one is a very large place. And when I saw that the last three were, you know, all three bedrooms, I just, what a shame, you know, because here we have our family. This was the only available rental when we were looking. And this was pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Michelle. Mm-hmm. Looking for housing, you know, hers, the place she's at, that was the only available place. And it was because we knew someone. So.
And I remember Jake, when we would talk to Jake, you know, he'd say, well, I don't know if I can even run for mayor again because I have to live in the city and it's impossible to find housing in the city. Right. I mean, come on. Your mayor?
Yeah, you know? If you have more than like one or two kids, it's going to be very difficult to find space here. And I just, I mean, that just really made me sad to see. And I it's bittersweet because I understand that these are people who, you know, this could be someone who they spent their whole life here and they worked their way up and bought this place and are excited and fixed it up and turned it into a rental. And, mm-hmm. and I get that. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't take away from the fact that we need sustainability here in Brookings, Oregon, and turning these large houses that could be used for families who are currently searching for housing now, turning that into short-term rental that they'll never be able to utilize. It just is heartbreaking.
No, it really is. And you know, if it's throwing people out on the street, basically, you know, who are already living in those homes that are being turned into short-term vacation
Yes, that
rentals,
does happen.
Right?
Yeah.
So they're getting turned out on the street. They've got nowhere to go. They have a life here in Brookings, right? They've got jobs. They've got their kids are going to the schools. I mean, they are part of the community, and they get turned out so that it can be turned into a moneymaker. And I get it. I do. I understand. People want to be able to make as much money as they possibly can, you know, that ensures their survival. But it's bad for our community. It's bad for mm-hmm. our city. It's bad for the commerce in our town. You can't have a town that is, you know, a tourist town and not have any workers.
I mean, right.
And if there's no place for the workers to live, we're going to lose the workers. I mean, of course we can't fill those spots with workers. There's no place to live. Nor can we fill the doctors that are needed or the nurses that are needed. I mean, somebody has to start thinking clearly about what this problem actually is.
Yeah.
It's not about moving the homeless down the road. That's not what it is. We're moving the whole community down the road.
Yeah. I mean, able-bodied workers, we're most of the people that obviously most of the people that we work with, well, I guess it's not obvious, but they are, you know, they have disabilities and they, and a lot of them have their own income and they have various different things going on, but we do have, you know, a large portion of people who are able-bodied workers who often will get a job and then they're sleeping in their car and they'll lose that job. I can tell you a scenario of a younger woman who, after several years, got out of a domestic violence situation and moved here. And then she ended up homeless and was staying in her vehicle. Well, she ended up getting a job not too long ago at the, I think it was the end of last year, got a job here locally in the, you know, tourism industry and was unable to find housing still. So she was still staying in her car. They made it illegal to sleep in town. So she was driving up river every night to sleep and coming into town to work. And her car ran out of gas one day up river and she lost her job. Ugh. So, you know, I'd love to say like, man, that happened, but we haven't seen it since. But it's just, it just happens so often that, we kind of scramble when, you know, somebody's like, yeah, I have a job offer. We're scrambling to try to find some supporting resources for them until they get a couple of paychecks and are able to either get a motel for a little while or, but honestly, when people reach out to us to look for housing, I tell them right off the bat, like we, and this is, I don't know how many people know this, but we actually don't help people look for housing specifically. We will help people sign up for HUD. We'll help you get on the wait list for the low-income apartments. Sometimes if there's something specific, especially if there's like a really urgent situation, sometimes we'll try to like find something if it's very specific. But in general, we don't help people look for housing. And the reason why is because we have, each of us, we don't have like caseloads, so it's kind of hard to put it that way. But altogether, our team works with about 90 individuals. And so roughly 30 people each. And almost all of them are looking for housing. And most of them can afford some type of housing. Not really the housing you find here, but most of them have income is what I mean. So if we were to try to find housing for all, you know, 90 individuals, we, you know, let's say we've a studio apartment comes up, who do we pick? You know,
yeah, exactly.
What do we do? Exactly. Do we go down the list and say who's the most needy, who asked first? Right. What do we do? There's not enough housing for the people we're working with. And so immediately when someone says, you know, I can't stay in the situation where I'm in, I don't like being here, I need to help get help finding other housing, my immediate thought is don't leave where you're at. I don't know what it's like outside of any, you know, obviously outside of like domestic violence and things like that, you may want to think about staying there for a little while longer.
Right.
But when people come in, this happens often, when people come in and they sit down and they say, I just need to find, if I can just find a little studio or a little one bedroom, you know, my heart sinks because I like to be pretty optimistic, but at this point where we're at right now, you know, the honest to God truth is when most of the people walking in and saying that, I know they're not going to find anything.
Oh, exactly.
And,
I see people on Facebook all the time saying, oh yeah, I want to move to Brookings, right? I want to move to Brookings. I'm coming from Nevada. And, you know, I just need a place to live. And it's like, wow, girlfriend, do not come.
And we look at them like they're crazy. What are you talking about? You just need a place to live That's something you can just find anywhere.
I know.
What makes you think you can just find a place to live here?
And isn't that crazy that you can't? I mean, seriously. And when you think about things like the ADUs, the accessory dwelling units, right?
Yeah, you got it.
Which are so... That would be such an easy solution.
It really would.
I mean, come on, such an easy solution. And if we found 100 people in this town who would be willing to put an ADU on their property and could, and the fees weren't exorbitant and all of that stuff, we could think where we would be with the housing issue. Right?
Yeah.
100 new dwellings and just little ones, right? Just little ones. But
that's most of the people we work with. Right? They just need a one bedroom, no bedroom, just an open room, a box. Right. I mean, they're not picky.
I know. And we're not talking about people who are down and have nothing. We're talking about people who have jobs who just need a place to live.
Or a lot of seniors on fixed income that it's just, I mean, it's guaranteed rent. It's not, most of the people, really thinking about it, all of the seniors we're working with, barring maybe a couple that have some pretty significant, cognitive issues, most of the seniors we're working with are just, I mean, you wouldn't even know that they're there. They're not homeless because, you know, they're drug addicts and they're, having all kinds of existential crises. They're homeless because they just can't find housing and they're on fixed incomes. They've, you know, whether the rent was raised where they were at and they couldn't afford it or, they traveled here and then couldn't find housing. But, I mean, if you had 50 little studios for $500 a month, I could easily find 50 people to put in there that you're never going to have a problem with. And they have income currently and would pay their rent on time.
Right.
I mean, it's really a no-brainer that these accessory dwelling units would provide immediate housing. We all know that.
Yep.
But who would be in there? And I think that could be some hesitation. I don't think it is right now because the plan's not really on the table. But if it was... There may be hesitation around, well, who's going to go in all these places and we have to have it as long-term housing. Really the majority of people we work with, there's not, they're not struggling with these issues that people think they are. They're not struggling.
That would make them scary or anything.
Right. Nope.
Yeah,
nope.
Exactly.
Nope.
We're not talking scary people here. We're talking just regular people who have nowhere to live.
Yeah.
Right?
Like this very sweet old lady who like literally just needs a place to live was this wonderful like real estate agent before she lost her vision. And this is the one who kind of, you know, had said, I would rather die than be homeless. And, she's getting very close and it's very concerning for all of us because I can see that she's very scared. There's nobody that I believe living in their 60s and 70s that should be living on the street for any reason, especially when they have an income. That's just absurd.
No. It's ridiculous. And, you know, I keep harking back to this, that I really think it's about city planning. I really do. I think that this is a planning issue. And I'm frankly appalled that there hasn't been planning. I'm kind of appalled. Like, what were they thinking 10 years ago? Were they thinking that Brookings was going to grow? And if they were thinking, what were the plans being made? Oh, there were no plans.
Yeah.
We were just hoping it was going to work out somehow, that somehow the contractors and the builders would – kind of appear. And I mean, really, really, where was the planning? Where was it? Where is it now?
I mean, it a lot of money went into that study several years later, but the city did not take that study and implement it into the planning department in a way that would move the goal forward. It was just sort of there. It's just sort of hanging there. And to my knowledge, although, you know, this was several months ago when it was brought up, but the housing study was brought up. I think I brought it up actually at one of the city council meetings, and nobody there had read the housing study. And I mean, I've thoroughly read the housing study. It has very good information in it. Mm-hmm. It's very informative, and they could really use that as a backboard to what gaps we have and start coming up with some plans on how to implement that. But even just the ADUs, right? Like that's a quick thing. I don't see any downside to that. I'm not a developer, but I've certainly lived in that field for a while when I was younger. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't see any downsides to the ADUs.
Well, and you would think that, you know, so let's make an assumption just for the moment that an ADU is not going to solve all of our problems, right?
Right.
Nevertheless, it's something. It's a step in the right direction. And I don't see any steps being taken. I don't see, I see our electeds at the county level and as well as the city level just kind of sitting back and saying, well, we're not going to do anything. It's not our job to do anything. It's just our job to kind of manage what's here, which is like, that's insane.
Yeah.
That's just insane.
Well, the county, I mean, it's hard to comment on the county, but the county has taken some initiative of sorts as far as they have the housing committee. They are, you know, they're putting together the American Rescue Plan committee. They certainly have a lot of committees, don't they?
Yes, they are doing a lot of talking.
After I said that, I was like, yeah, that's really...
I want to see what they're doing.
I know, that's a lot of it. And honestly, you know, in the beginning, it took me a while to figure out, like, why isn't Bernie involved in any of these meetings? Because it's really ground zero, St. Mm-hmm. Timothy's mm-hmm. is, and has been for a long time. That's not new. And so I thought, why isn't Bernie involved more? And, you know, as the months went on and I was around St. Timothy's more and started working there, you know, it kind of made sense because Bernie really does not like sitting around talking about things.
Yep.
Which sometimes I am like, well, maybe we should talk just a little bit longer before we start moving. But also there's some sense of... fluidity in that is comforting when we're dealing with all these crises, because that's how we were formed. I mean, really, I came to Bernie and was like, there's this need that I'm seeing, and it's huge, and God has really put this on my heart, and I really think that I'm ready for this. I forget what it's called. I want to say mission, but that's not what I mean. Anyway, I'm ready for this this charge. And with Bernie being kind of as fluid as he was like, okay, like, you know, he wanted to see more, obviously, but I was very grateful.
But it was about doing it. It was about,
right, that's exactly,
you know,
what it is.
Right? Yeah. It's like you hear an idea and that the idea has merit. So, you know, sure, we'll continue talking, but we're going to do something. We're not just going to sit around and talk about it.
And you know, when you do it that way, you are going to make some mistakes. I mean, there's certainly things that, looking back a year ago when we kind of actually started this, the core team, even though we weren't, mm-hmm. that's not what we called ourselves. There's certainly several things I can think of, like, oh, I wish I'd have done that one a little different, mm-hmm. or this. But the people, I can honestly say that there are people whose lives we've saved in a year since we've been doing this that I don't know. I mean, it's really hard to comment on things like life and death. Because there's no certainty in that, and there's no way to ever know if we were the impact, you know.
But the likelihood is.
But there are some that we are I mean, we are the likelihood so very is sure yeah. that that we made a big impact there. Yeah. And so had we waited till we had our ducks in a row, it'd look a lot different, wouldn't
mm-hmm,
it?
Mm-hmm. It would look different. And there might be some people who didn't make it because yeah. you waited. And I kind of think that's where we are, you know?
Yes, I think so too. And we need to
stop sitting around talking about it and what the good ideas are and move on it.
Take a page from Bernie's book.
Yeah, exactly. And start moving. I mean, we know that ADUs are a good idea, and we know that it would certainly do something to address the issues. We know that. Mm-hmm. And we also know that some kind of a cap on turning long-term rentals into short-term rentals, we know that would work. So we've come up with two ideas, just you and me.
We could solve it, Brookings. We got this.
We could solve it, electeds. We could solve the problem, all right? You just need to do it. Mm-hmm. Just need to stop talking about it and do it before any more people die out there on the street. Because, you know, that's what's happening. You
know? Yeah, we're seeing, I mean, we always have at least one case where we're worried about getting that call. And the other day we couldn't find this person and mm-hmm. found out they were at the hospital. And despite being the emergency contact and having a release information, mm-hmm. they didn't give us any information. And Michelle thought for that whole day that this person was dead and they just weren't telling her.
Oh, wow. Would they? So, oh, well, yeah, of course they would do that if they weren't giving you information.
Mm-hmm. And we're the emergency contact and we have a release. And so it was very scary because.
Did she end up back at St. Tim's?
He. No, he was dropped off in a wheelchair with his pants half on down at Botanical Gardens.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Yeah. So she texted me the next morning and said, I found him. So it was relieving, but also just quite confusing and yeah.
Well, you just wonder how is it that we've gotten to the point where we think treating people like that is okay?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just so not okay.
And a senior, you know, on. This person has lived his whole life. He should get to be okay now.
And was probably very productive during the life.
Probably. He's a great guy.
Yeah, that's just a shame. Well, it looks like we're about out of time again. Those funny green signs are coming up. are you on that advisory committee with the county, where they're
American
looking
Rescue
at the money?
Plan?
Yeah, they're looking at
I
the money.
I submitted an application.
All right. Well, let's talk about that next time.
I'm going to check now to make sure I've fully submitted that.
Good.
Now that I just said that.
Yeah, let's do that.
So.
Well, this was another great conversation. We talked about stuff I didn't even know we were going to talk about, which is always fun. But it all does come back to housing as well. So
it does.
And thank you for listening. Remember, we actually do have answers for the problems that we've got. We just need to do it. So step up and do it. This is Candace Michelle for Our Community. See you next week.